Well, we're in Daniel chapter 8. And Daniel chapter 8 is going back to Hebrew. So if you remember when we first started this, we said that all of chapter 1 and the beginning of chapter 2 was in Hebrew. And then from chapter 2, verse 4, all the way through the end of chapter 7 was in Aramaic. And now Daniel's going back to Hebrew again. And beginning in chapter 8, we've got some visions specifically with regard to the Medo-Persian Empire and the Greek Empire. And the vision he has here in chapter 8 is going to be greatly expanded into some incredible detail once we get to chapter 11. In fact, chapter 11 is probably the most detailed passage in all of the Bible prophetically. The detail of chapter 11 is absolutely phenomenal. And when we get closer to chapter 11, I'm going to send some notes that are going to help you understand chapter 11, because chapter 11 goes through a whole series of kings of the north, kings of the south, and you're going to need some notes to figure out which kings he's actually talking about. So when we get closer to that, I'll send some notes. If you look at the beginning of chapter 8, the events here took place in the third year of Belshazzar. In chapter 7, the events took place in the first year of Belshazzar. In chapter 5, Belshazzar dies. So like we've said before, these chapters aren't in chronological order. So chapter 7 took place in the first year of Belshazzar in 553 BC. Chapter 8 takes place in the third year of Belshazzar, which would be 551-550 BC. And chapter 5 takes place in 539 BC. And 539 was the demise of the Babylonian Empire being replaced by the Medo-Persian Empire. Okay. So he says in the third year of Belshazzar, or in the third year of the reign of Belshazzar, king of Babylon, a vision appeared to me, Daniel, subsequent to the one which appeared to me previously, which was the one in chapter 7. I looked in the vision, and while I was looking, I was in the citadel of Susa, which is in the province of Elam. Now, I'm going to share some maps with you. So Susa, if you look on this map, the green area was the area of primary Babylonian influence, and then they expanded north, and they expanded east, and then they expanded south along the Mediterranean coast. They didn't really, I mean west, not east, they didn't really expand toward the eastern direction. So Babylon is right here. Susa is almost due east in the Persian region, or the Elamite region. It was actually one of the major cities in the Elamite territory. In fact, it was the capital of the Elamite territory. And Daniel sees himself in this vision, and Susa is actually going to become one of the primary residents of the Persian kings. So, for example, if you look at Nehemiah chapter 1, in Nehemiah chapter 1, Daniel or Nehemiah says, the words of Nehemiah, the son of Hakaliah, it happened in the month Cheslev in the 20th year while I was in Susa, the capital. So Daniel is actually during the reign of the Babylonian Empire, seeing the capital city of the next empire to come. In the book of Esther, chapter 1, took place in the days of Ahasuerus. Ahasuerus here would be Xerxes the First. Verse 2, in those days, as King Ahasuerus sat on his royal throne, which was at the citadel of Susa. So Daniel is in this citadel, the capital of the next empire, and he sees this vision of these two animals. So he says, I looked in the vision. I was in the capital or in the citadel of Susa, which was in the province of Elam. I looked in the vision, and I myself was beside the Ulai Canal. And he sees two animals. And so the first animal he sees, I lifted up my eyes and looked, and behold, a ram, which had two horns, was standing in front of the canal. And verse 21, if you just jump down there for a second, tells us that the ram represents the kings of Media and Persia. Okay? And while you're down there, verse 21, the shaggy goat is going to represent the kingdom of Greece. So Daniel is looking ahead. He's seeing in this vision, he finds himself in the capital city of the next empire. And he sees this ram, it's got two horns. And he says the two horns were long. One was longer than the other. The longer one coming up last. So if you remember back in chapter 7, you had these four animals representing these four kingdoms. So the winged lion represented Babylon. The lopsided bear represented Medo-Persia. And it was lopsided because that empire was a lopsided empire. The Persians, even though they came up last, were stronger than the Medians. And so the bear was lopsided. Here, Daniel is saying this ram, it's got two horns. The longer horn came up last. That would represent the Persian division of the Medo-Persian Empire. It came up last, but it was stronger. And if here's another map, this is actually the colored area on this map is the Medo-Persian Empire. And the Persians were down in this area, down in here. The Medians were up in here, and they joined forces together. And most of their push was to the west, and then up to the north, and then down to the south. They did go a little bit to the east, but the majority of their push was to the west. And in fact, when we get into chapter 11, you'll see that under Xerxes, they pushed all the way to Greece. And it was because of Xerxes and his push to the Greeks, that the Greeks finally came to power and turned against the Persians. And you're going to see that in this chapter as well. So the ram is budding westward toward this direction, northward into Armenia and up in here, and southward, they went all the way down into Egypt and into the regions of what would be called Kush or Ethiopia. So they had a fairly vast empire. And he says, no other beasts could stand before him. And the beasts here are obviously representative of nations. The lion in chapter 7 represented Babylon. The bear represented Medo-Persia. The leopard represented Greece. So no other beasts could stand before the Persians. When they marched in, they conquered. Except for the last empire. They tried to take the Greeks, but they failed. And they lost miserably. So nor was there anyone to rescue from his power. He did as he pleased and magnified himself. And that's a pretty good picture of Xerxes. If you jump over to chapter 11, he says in verse 2, and Daniel is writing during the reigns of Darius the Mede and Cyrus the Persian. So they're co-rulers. And he says in 11:2, three more kings are going to arise in Persia. We'll get into who those three are when we get to chapter 11. Then a fourth will gain far more riches than all of them. And as soon as he becomes strong through his riches, and this is a reference to Xerxes the first, Esther calls him Ahasuerus, he will arouse the whole empire against the realm of Greece. So he's going to push all the way into Europe. So remember, all of this over here, this is all Asia. You know, people think Asia is like India and Nepal and Thailand, and you know, they think that's Asia. The fact of the matter is the Middle East is actually part of Asia. Turkey is part of Asia. And Europe doesn't begin until you cross this little strait here, right? So when you cross this strait, then you get into Europe. So the Persians pushed all the way into Europe and they lost. So chapter 11 gives us that picture. So he's budding westward and northward and southward and doing as he pleases. That's pretty much what Xerxes did. Nobody stood in his way. He conquered everyone in his path except the Greeks. He did as he pleased, magnified himself. So then he says in verse 5, while I was observing, back in chapter 8, behold, a male goat was coming from the west. So this would be the Greek Empire. And if you look, you know, compare the Persian Empire did go much farther north than the Greeks, but the Greeks actually went as far east, if not a little bit farther, than the Persians. So this male goat coming from the west, and notice how he describes this male goat as he travels. He's coming from the west over the surface of the whole earth without touching the ground. In other words, there's this portrayal of incredible speed. Once he starts going, he doesn't even touch the ground. He just keeps on going east, and he conquers everything in his path. If you remember the beast back in chapter 7, it was the leopard with four wings. So the leopard, being one of the fastest animals in the world, now has four wings on top of it. And here he's portrayed as traveling over the surface of the whole earth without ever touching the ground. And he says the goat had a conspicuous horn between his eyes. So the goat, we saw a little later on in this chapter, in verse 21, the goat represented Greece. The conspicuous horn represents his first king. Again, if you go back to chapter 11, he says, after Xerxes the first comes against the realm of Greece, he says in verse 3, a mighty king will arise. This is Alexander the Great. He will rule with great authority, do as he pleases. So this conspicuous horn between the eyes of the goat is Alexander the Great. So he came up to the ram that had the two horns, which I had seen standing in front of the canal, rushed at him in his mighty wrath. So the ram, the goat is angry. And he's angry at the ram because of what the Persians had done historically to the Greeks. And so now the Greeks are going to retaliate. So the Greeks are moving with mighty wrath against the Persians. And he says, I saw him come beside the ram. He was enraged at him. He struck the ram, shattered his two horns. So shattered both elements of that empire. And the ram had no strength to withstand him. He hurled him to the ground, trampled on him, and there was none to rescue the ram from his power. So Alexander is flying across the known world, not even touching the ground, conquers the entire Persian Empire, and actually goes farther east than he did. Then the male goat magnified himself, and what happened to the Persians, their final defeat took place. The final defeat of the Persians took place in this region up here in what is now Nineveh, or was Nineveh. So Nineveh, the capital of the former Assyrian Empire, is also the place where Alexander defeats Darius III, and the Persian Empire, the Medo-Persian Empire, comes to an end. So 331 BC. Then something happens to the Greeks. So the male goat magnified himself exceedingly, and as soon as he was mighty, the large horn was broken. So when he talks about the breaking of the large horn, that's the demise of Alexander the Great. And he died in 323. So he defeated the Persians in 331. He ends up dying in 323. So he really doesn't get to enjoy the fruits of his vast empire very long. And he says, as he was mighty, the large horn was broken, and in its place, there came up four conspicuous horns toward the four winds of heaven. So in place of Alexander the Great, that one conspicuous horn, four other horns came up in its place. So again, remember chapter 7, how many heads did the leopard have? Four heads. Now this male goat has four horns. So go back to chapter 11. He says in verse 4, as soon as he has arisen, this is Alexander, his kingdom will be broken up and parceled out toward the four points of the compass. So as soon as Alexander conquers all of this region, this entire realm, he dies, his kingdom is divvied up to the four winds of heaven. And he says in 11:4, though not to his own descendants, he had two sons that should have taken his place, but they were murdered. And so his empire, this vast empire here, was divvied up to four of his generals. And Cassander took this region right here. Cassander took basically what is now Macedonia and Greece. Lysimachus took Thrace, Bithynia, Asia Minor. He took that region. Seleucus basically took Syria and everything to the west or to the east. So Seleucus actually got the largest portion of the empire. When we get into chapter 11, Seleucus is the beginning of the kings of the north. So the Seleucid dynasty comes from General Seleucus. His fourth general, Ptolemy, took Egypt and parts of Palestine. And again, when we get into chapter 11, Ptolemy is the beginning of the kings of the south, or the Ptolemaic dynasty. So Alexander's kingdom is divvied up to these four generals. And he says, in chapter 11, he says, though not according to his authority, which he wielded, his sovereignty will be uprooted and to given others beside him. And then he goes into the whole kings of the north, kings of the south. So now we've got these, the Greek empire is divided into four regions. And beginning in verse 9, we have the emergence of another little horn. So if you remember back in chapter 7, we had a little horn coming from the fourth beast. So when we look at the beasts in chapter 7, you had the lion, which represented Babylon. You had the bear, which represented Medo-Persia. You had the leopard, which represented Greece. And then you had the dreadful, terrifying beast, the thing that some artists portray as a Tyrannosaurus Rex, representing the Roman Empire. And then out of a future aspect of the Roman Empire, you've got 10 horns, and then another little horn that springs up from among them, which is ultimately defeated at the second coming of Christ. So the little horn in chapter 7 represented a future king coming out of a future aspect of the Roman Empire who is defeated by Christ at his second coming. The little horn in chapter 8 comes out of the Greek Empire, and he's defeated a little later on when we get down here, end of verse 25, he will be broken without human agency, kind of like the Antichrist, but he comes out of a totally different empire. So don't confuse the little horn of chapter 7 with the little horn of chapter 8. The little horn of chapter 7 comes out of a future aspect of the Roman Empire and represents the Antichrist. The little horn of chapter 8 comes out of the Greek Empire and represents an individual known as Antiochus the Fourth Epiphanes. So you're going to see some of the things that about Antiochus the Fourth here. Also, if you jump over to chapter 11 again, beginning in verse 21 and going all the way to verse 35. So 11:21 to 11:35 is talking about the same person. 11:21 to 11:35 is the little horn of chapter 8. And he's called a despicable person. 11:36 to 11:45 is the little horn of chapter 7. Okay, so keep those little horns separate. Chapter 7's little horn is 11:36 to 45. Chapter 8's little horn is 11:21 to 35. Okay, so keep those things separate. One is from a future aspect of the Romans, one is from the Greeks. So this little horn, so out of the four of them came a rather small horn, which grew exceedingly toward the south, toward the east, and toward the beautiful land. So remember, the Seleucid dynasty, this guy comes out of the Seleucid dynasty. He's one of the kings of the north. The Seleucid dynasty took over Syria primarily, and then most of the region to the east. But here he's portrayed as growing exceedingly toward the south. Well, what's south of Assyria? Or not Assyria. What's south of Syria? Palestine, Israel is south of Syria, and Egypt. And when we get into chapter 8, chapter 11, you're going to see this really well. Antiochus the Fourth Epiphanes made constant incursions into Egypt, and he had to go through Israel. And when he went through Israel, he wreaked havoc. And eventually, the Romans, and when we get into chapter 11, you're going to see this, the Romans were becoming a world power at this time. And so he makes this incursion into Egypt, and the Romans intervene. And the Romans basically said to him, "You leave now, and we'll let you go. You stay, you're not going anywhere." So he left, and on his way out, he got to go through Israel, and now he's angry. And he takes out his wrath on the Jews. So, and Daniel here in chapter 8 says that, but you get a lot more detail about this guy in chapter 11. So he goes toward the south, he goes toward the east, he goes toward the beautiful land. So he makes these incursions through the beautiful land to the south into Egypt. And it grew up to the host of heaven. And the host of heaven is usually a portrayal of the people of Israel. The Abrahamic covenant frequently refers to Abraham's descendants as numerous as the stars in the heavens and the sand of the seashore. So this guy is growing up, you know, becoming powerful against the host of heaven and causing some of the host and some of the stars to fall to the earth. So he brings about some horrible things against the Jews. This guy, when he goes through Israel, he's just indiscriminately killing people, and eventually he will desecrate the temple, he will put a stop to the sacrifices, and he's causing some of the host and some of the stars, the leaders of Israel, to fall to the earth and trampling them down. He killed like 150,000 Jews in his anger at the Romans and the Egyptians. It even, verse 11, magnified itself to be equal with the commander of the host. So the commander of the host is God. And so Antiochus the IV is saying, I'm equal with God. And in fact, the word Epiphanes, Antiochus the IV Epiphanes means Antiochus the IV, the glorious one. So he's claiming the glory and the honor that belongs to God. And it removed the regular sacrifice from him. So eventually Antiochus, as he's going through and taking over parts of Israel, he decides, you know, no more sacrifices. So he puts a stop to the sacrifices. He the place of God's sanctuary is thrown down. So one of the things he did was take a pig and sacrificed it on the altar, and then took the blood and the broth of the pig and took it into the temple and sprayed it everywhere. So he desecrated the temple with the blood and broth of a sow. And then he took an idol of Zeus and put it into the holy place in the temple. So he puts a stop to the sacrifices. He desecrates the sanctuary. And then he says, Daniel says in verse 11, on account of transgression, the host will be given over to the horn along with the regular sacrifice. So the Jews are again sinning against God. So remember, you know, throughout their history, every time the Jews sinned, God gave them into the hands of an oppressor. So the whole period of the judges, they would sin against God. God would raise up a nation to oppress them. They would cry out to God. God would raise up a judge who would deliver them. And when the judge died, they did it all over again. And then later on in their history, in the 700s, God raised up the Assyrians. Isaiah talks about this in the first part of Isaiah. Hosea talks about this. Amos and Joel and Micah talk about this. So God raised up the Assyrians, and in 722, the Assyrians came and took the northern kingdom away. And you would have thought that the southern kingdom of Judah would have learned the lesson from watching their northern brethren being carried away, but they didn't. So God raised up the Babylonians. And Daniel was part of that. The Babylonians came and took the Jews away to Babylon, destroyed the city, destroyed the temple. 70 years later, God sends them back. He promises a return, and the return is going to be under Zerubbabel, and then later under Ezra and under Nehemiah. Well, when they get back, things are going okay, sort of. There were still some issues that they were dealing with, but they begin sinning again. And God raises up this little horn on account of transgression. The Jews are going to be given over to Antiochus the IV Epiphanes, who's going to put a stop to the sacrifices. He says he's going to fling truth to the ground and perform its will and will prosper. So God gives the Jews over again to oppressors because they keep on sinning against him. Later on, nothing changes, really. later on after the Greeks are gone, the Romans are going to come up. They're going to keep on doing it, and the Romans are going to defeat them in the year 70 AD. So he keeps on judging his people, and they don't seem to be learning their lesson. In the future, he's going to raise up the Antichrist, and the Antichrist is going to do the same thing, and it's going to be at that time that finally they're going to learn their lesson. And Ezekiel talks about, in fact, if you read through Ezekiel, I would take a highlighter and highlight every time Ezekiel says, "And then they will know that I am the Lord." Dozens of times throughout the book of Ezekiel, "Then they will know that I am the Lord." So finally, they're going to come to this understanding and realization of who God is and their relationship to him. But at this point, on account of transgression, the host is given over to Antiochus the Fourth Epiphanes. So Daniel says in verse 13, "Then I heard a holy one speaking," an angel, "and another holy one said to that one, 'How long will the vision about the regular sacrifice apply while the transgression causes horror so as to allow both the holy place and the host to be trampled?'" So one angel says to another angel, "How long is this going to take place?" And he says, "For 2,300 evenings and mornings. And then the holy place will be properly restored." So that period of time began in 171 BC with the assassination of a man named Onias III. He was the last legitimate high priest at this point in time. He was murdered, and a pseudo line of high priests were put into power. 4 years later, on December 25th, 167, Antiochus the Fourth Epiphanes desecrates the temple. And then 3 years after that, Antiochus dies. And we'll look at how he dies a little later on. It's a rather gruesome story, and you don't want to be listening to it while you're eating a meal. So this 2,300 evenings and mornings basically is from the time of Onias III's assassination until the death of Antiochus the Fourth Epiphanes. And once Antiochus the Fourth was dead, then the temple could be restored. It could be cleansed, the altar rebuilt, and this is when the whole, what the Jews call the Feast of Dedication, John chapter 7 talks about that, that this is the time of Hanukkah. So when the Maccabees finally defeated the Greeks and Antiochus the Fourth died, then this period of time is over, the holy place is restored. So beginning in verse 15, Daniel is given the interpretation, which we've kind of already looked at. "So when I, Daniel, had seen the vision, I sought to understand it. And behold, standing before me was one who looked like a man. And I heard the voice of a man between the banks of the Ulai. He called out and said, 'Gabriel, give this man an understanding of the vision.'" So this is our first introduction to Gabriel. We're going to see him again in chapter 9. We're going to see him again in Luke chapter 1. He's the one who announces the birth of John the Baptist. He's the one who announces the birth of Mary. Or not Mary, Jesus to Mary. So Gabriel comes over, and when he came, I was frightened and fell on my face. This is one of those times, again, Daniel falls on his face. And if you look in verse 18, it says, while he was talking, I sank into a deep sleep. That's how Daniel describes he fainted. I mean, that's how we would describe it. If we pass out, we eventually wake up, you know, okay, how long was I out? So the appearance of Gabriel frightened Daniel to the point that he actually passed out. So he says to me, son of man, understand that the visions pertain to the time of the end. And I'll talk about that in a minute. While he was talking with me, I sank into a deep sleep. He fainted. He touched me, made me stand upright. Behold, I'm going to let you know what will occur at the final period of indignation, for it pertains to the appointed time of the end. Now, when Daniel writes about the time of the end, there's a couple ways of looking at this. Usually in the Old Testament, the time of the end doesn't necessarily refer to the future tribulation, second coming, millennial kingdom. Sometimes it does. But the time of the end or the end times is a term that's actually very broad. So for example, in Genesis 49, when Jacob is talking about the future of his sons in the land, he's referring to this as the latter days. So from our perspective, those latter days, that time of the end, was its history already. From their perspective, it was a time in the future. From our perspective, it's already happened. So when Daniel is talking about the time of the end, what he's talking about is something that's going to happen in a couple of centuries. So he's writing in the 500s BC, and the events are going to take place right after that. They're going to begin in just a few years from Daniel's perspective, and they're going to continue on until the middle of the second century BC. So that's the period he's talking about. It's prophetic, but from Daniel's perspective, it's historic from our perspective. Now, there is another element to this, and some see this as a type of dual fulfillment. Others see it as a picture, a type. So I personally would look at what he's talking about here not as a dual fulfillment, but as a typical event. So for example, the little horn in chapter 7 is a prophetic person. It's referring to the Antichrist. The little horn in chapter 8 is an historic person, Antiochus the Fourth Epiphanes, who died 2100 years ago. But he's also a typical person. In other words, Antiochus the Fourth Epiphanes was a type of the Antichrist. So some of the things that Antiochus the Fourth Epiphanes did, the Antichrist is also going to do. So he typified what the Antichrist is going to do. You could look at it in the sense that Antiochus the Fourth was an Antichrist wannabe. And so he's going to do some of the things that the Antichrist is going to do. He typified the Antichrist. I'm not sure I would go so far as to say it's a dual fulfillment, because you're dealing with two totally different empires here. I would look at this more as an historic and typical rather than a strictly dual prophetic. But that's just my opinion. So he says in verse 20, the ram which you saw, two horns, kings of Medo-Persia. Okay, we got that. The shaggy goat represents the kingdom of Greece. The large horn, its first king, Alexander the Great. The broken horn and the four horns taking its place, the four kingdoms which arise from that nation, Cassander, Lysimachus, Ptolemy, and Seleucus. In the latter period of their rule, this would take us all the way into the second century BC, when the transgressors have run their course, the Jews who are in the process of sinning against God again, a king will arise, Antiochus the Fourth Epiphanes, insolent, skilled in intrigue, and when we get into chapter 11, I mean, this guy was a conniver. He epitomized deceit. He would sit across the table from the king of Egypt, and these two would lie through their teeth to one another. Neither one of them believed a single word that the other said, and then they just went on their way all happy. He was skilled in intrigue, and in fact, how he got his throne is rather interesting as well. His power will be mighty, but not by his own power. In other words, his power is derived. God is allowing him to do what he's doing. And then God puts an end to him. Think of all these empires. Think of the Assyrians. The Assyrians, you know, did what they pleased. And then when you look at Isaiah chapter 10, God deals with the Assyrians. He calls them the rod of my anger and the staff in whose hand is my indignation. And then they exceeded their mandate. God puts an end to them. Same thing with the Babylonians. The Babylonians are doing their thing. And according to Habakkuk chapter 1, they exceeded their mandate. God puts an end to it. God raises up Antiochus the Fourth Epiphanes to deal with the Jews, the transgressors. He exceeds his mandate. God puts an end to it. And how he puts an end to it, really gross. He will destroy to an extraordinary degree, prosper and perform his will. He will destroy mighty men and the holy people. Tens of thousands of Jews died at his hand. Through his shrewdness, he will cause deceit to succeed by his influence. He will magnify himself in his heart. He will destroy while many at our ease. And again, this you're going to see this in chapter 11. He will even oppose the prince of princes. So God's the one that is allowing him to do what he's doing, and he's actually opposing God. And that's not going to end well. He will be broken without human agency. Okay, so now I'm going to read a passage out of the Apocrypha. This is 2 Maccabees chapter 9, verses 5 to 9. And it talks about Antiochus the Fourth. And in fact, if you want a decent history of this period, the Maccabees, 1st, 2nd, 3rd, and 4th Maccabees, actually give a fairly decent history of this period of time. So this is his demise. Now, I'll just read it for you, and please don't be eating anything right now. The all-seeing Lord, the God of Israel, struck him with an incurable and invisible blow. As soon as he stopped speaking, he was seized with a pain in his bowels, from which there was no relief, and with sharp internal tortures, and that very justly, for he had tortured the bowels of others with many and strange inflictions. don't even want to go there. Yet he did not in any way stop his insolence, but was even more filled with arrogance, breathing fire in his rage against the Jews and giving orders to drive even faster. And so it came about that he fell out of his chariot as it was rushing along, and the fall was so hard as to torture every limb of his body. Thus he who only a little while before had thought in his superhuman arrogance that he could command the waves of the sea, and had imagined that he could weigh the high mountains in a balance, was brought down to earth and carried in a litter, making the power of God manifest to all. And so the ungodly man's body swarmed with worms, and while he was still living in anguish and pain, his flesh rotted away, and because of the stench, the whole army felt revulsion at his decay. So when Daniel says he was broken without human agency, yeah, he kind of means what he says. So the angel goes on and he says, the vision of the evenings and mornings, which has been told, is true, but keep the vision secret. It pertains to the days, to many days future. So you don't need to tell people about this because they're probably not going to believe you anyway. And especially when you get into chapter 11, you know, talking about the kings of the north and the kings of the south and the kings of the north, nobody's going to believe you, Daniel, until it happens. So I, Daniel, was exhausted and sick for days. And then I got up and carried on the king's business. But I was astounded at the vision, and there was none to explain it. Even though the angel had explained it, he didn't get it. I mean, there were so many things in this vision. I just don't understand. And there's no one to talk to about this. And he's going to feel the very same way when we get into chapter 11. His mind is going to be boggled when we get into chapter 11. So, any questions?
Jeff, I got a question. Oh, go ahead. Sorry. Someone else.
All right. Dave's got a question.
Let Ray first.
Okay. So, Jeff, you know, again, it's striking the parallels, as you were saying, between Antiochus, the fourth Epiphanes, and the Antichrist. Even the time frame, 2,300 days, care to elaborate on that or just kind of talk about that a little bit? It's amazing how similar kind of these patterns occur. I know you said he's a type, but...
I'm not sure where the 2,300 days comes in.
It's the amount of time between Antiochus's death and that, that period. Let's see here. What does it say?
The murder of Onias and Antiochus's death.
That's correct. Yeah.
Okay. I don't see a parallel with that with the Antichrist, though.
No, I meant to say that, and maybe I've got this wrong. So 2,300 days. 2,300 evenings and mornings. Maybe you're right. I was just thinking about the Great Tribulation.
I see what you're saying. The Great Tribulation, when he looks at that, that period of time is usually thought of as 3.5 years, a time times half a time, and 1,260 days. So it's always looked at instead of the entire 7 years, and we get that, we're going to get that once we get into chapter 9, that last period of seven, it's always looked at in halves. And so you got the first half is 1260, the second half is 1260. But this, he's looking at the entire period of 2300.
Yeah, I should have added up my days, but really then that's fine. Yeah, that's, I should have just added up the days and compared them, but thank you, Jeff. Appreciate it.
Hi, Jeff. Thank you for your insightful thoughts. Joanne and I had the privilege last fall of being in Greece, and we were taken to the places where these battles took place between, well, Darius and I guess we didn't see Darius, but Xerxes the First, where he did battle against the Greeks. Apparently, Darius didn't bring a big enough army, and he was held up at a town called Marathon. And the Greeks were able to meet him there. And a runner, one of the soldiers, ran 26 miles back to Athens to tell the people that they had just defeated defeated Darius. And that's how the marathon races came from, in the Olympics and so on. But supposedly, according to what they told us, Xerxes, who is quite old at this time when he married Esther, Xerxes the First, that he came with, now that's what they told us, 250,000 men. So he was going to really do havoc. And there was a place kind of like the we had at Concord, where some militiamen stood up against them. It was the Spartan king Leonidas and 300 men. And they held him back for a while, but they were eventually killed. But he went into Athens and destroyed Athens completely. Again, his weak link, or I should say his Achilles heel, he didn't have a strong enough navy. Mm-hmm. And so he gets down to south of Athens, and the more agile ships of the Greeks were able to defeat his navy. And it says that Xerxes the First was standing on the shore and seeing this demise.